Welcome to another episode of New Books and Poetry. I'm your host, John Ebersole, and I'm delighted to be joined by poet Angie Malenko, whose most recent book of verse is titled Marvelous Things Overheard, Ferrer Strauss Giroux, 2013. Her most recent work invites us to the Med, which is the title of one of her poems, and is short not only for the Mediterranean, but in our more modern context, short for medicine, which her poetry is for that reader needing to admit they are sick with not indifference to human history, but with the guilt they feel in their bones for not pursuing it. But Malenko's poetry does not set out to shame the reader, but a generous poetry that waits patiently for that reader's arrival. Ultimately, Malenko's work is about time, deep time and human time, that yields the enchantment of language, the enchantment of beauty and form, and finally the enchantment of wisdom, which we seek to answer the question, how shall I live? Malenko's poetry is where image and sound deliver the difficult pleasures, which are the ones worth having. Angie Malenko, welcome to New Books and Poetry.
Thank you for having me. Thanks for that nice introduction.
Oh, you're quite welcome. Before we get started, I have some really kind of ridiculous two questions to ask you. The author photograph on your new book has you in a leather jacket. And I've always been jealous of those who can pull that off, which I think you do. But I was wondering, is that your leather jacket or was that kind of something the photographer came up with?
No, that's my leather jacket.
I was just curious.
Actually, go ahead. I don't wear it that often. I'm getting too old for that leather jacket. So.
Well, you pull it off. You pull it off quite nicely. And recently, I in preparation for our chat today, I went to a couple audio interviews, one in particular that you did, and that I'm so taken with your reading voice that it is perhaps one of the most just beautiful reading voices I've heard in so long. And I was wondering if you've had any sort of vocal training whatsoever, or is this just something that organically is just kind of a talent you have organically?
Wow, I have never actually been told that. No, I have no vocal training. I can't sing for beans, which has always been a huge regret in my life. But actually, no, I try not to listen to myself as much as possible. Somebody told me I really should listen to myself because that's how you get better. But I have a terror of listening to myself.
I totally kind of agree because, like, with even my interviews, like in the beginning, I was very like, I listened to them meticulously. But after like a while, I don't even go near them hardly anymore. It's weird. But I was just wondering because I think the sound of your poetry lends to it, you know, kind of a scaffolding in which your voice can play upon. But that it's never too fast, never too slow. And that the pacing of it and just the sound of it, it matches well with your poetry. I think your voice is particularly designed to read your poetry, and that's just an incredible thing for me. Before we get started and kind of diving into Marvelous Things Overheard, I couldn't help, because I'm in the Philly area, I noticed lately the bios I read for you is very adamant about where you were born, and it says Philadelphia. So I was wondering how long did you live here? Were you just kind of born here and whisked off quickly, or what was your time in Pennsylvania like?
Oh, it is, you know, my formative experience. I lived there until I went to college.
Oh, wow.
In Annapolis, yeah. And then I came home for summers, or most of the summers, and then I moved to Boston after graduation, and I have not been back except to visit. So I actually have a strong nostalgia for the landscape, the topography, the trees. It's just a beautiful, beautiful area, and I actually, you know, my early life was in the city. My parents lived in the city. My grandparents always lived in the Northeast. So until I was 40, you know, I was going to visit my grandmother in Northeast Philadelphia. So not that long ago. So
yeah, that's incredible. Yeah, I live right in, I live right kind of outside. I don't know if you've ever, you probably have, I don't know, the Flower Town area. It's kind of near Chestnut Hill. So I've lived here for a couple of years, and it's a great, it's an interesting city. But yeah, you haven't been back. Yeah, it has like a kind of a, it's a weird mix of like an agrarian slash urban vibe to it. So you were here till you moved away to college, is that right?
Yes, yes.
And that was in Annapolis?
Yeah, I went to college at St. John's College, the Great Books Program.
Mm-hmm.
And I studied, apropos for this book, I studied ancient Greek for 2 years.
Right.
It was a, philosophy, Great Books based program, so it was heavy on philosophy, not as heavy on poetry.
Hmm. And did you, it's my understanding you went, you eventually ended up at Brown, is that right?
Mm-hmm. I took a few years off. I wasn't sure I wanted to be in a program, but I eventually realized that it wasn't so rewarding to just have odd jobs and try to write in the evenings.
Right.
So eventually I went to Brown.
And did you follow kind of that traditional or what seems traditional now trajectory for poets? Did you do their MFA program or was it another kind of situation?
No, I did the MFA program. There's some confusion about, what MFA programs are for, and there's confusion about, whether real poets go to MFA programs. I wanted to be a poet since I was 16. I fell in love with poetry as a teenager and pretty much was an autodidact in it for 10 years before I went to grad school. But grad school is particularly good for just being able to, get a stipend and focus on poetry. I was able to teach it for a year. So those were valuable things. But I already probably came too formed to it to really get much out of it as an educational experience.
Right. And you mentioned that you started kind of, poetry sort of found you when you were like 16 years old. What can you say about that? Like, how'd that generally unfold?
It's hard to say. I think that, adolescence is, really an emotional, obviously, hormonal time. And so something about the, the intersection of, very intense language and the intensest time of your life, they're probably made for each other in a certain way. I had written, for a long time. I wanted to be a writer in a general sense since I was probably 7. But then poetry, much to my parents' chagrin and against all practical judgment, poetry sort of overtook any other interest.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about your family's reaction for taking that course, I think. And you said like practical, I think, we live in a culture obsessed with utility and like saying you're going to be a poet. I mean, I literally will tell people like that's where I ended up and they just shake their head like baffled. Did your family, were they really resistant to it or just kind of like, what was their reaction to your kind of trajectory towards literature and poetry?
Some of it was just bafflement. But my father was particularly upset or irritated because, they were immigrants and there's a typical immigrant desire for their children to make it, to make money, to be settled, to be secure. And I was the oldest, and I spent a lot of their money on college tuition. So I think they thought, I should be, successful in a different way. And they weren't aware of the sort of that there's, cultural capital in being a poet. They never grasped that aspect of it, that, you know, and they never saw me as, you know, going to, you know, possibly being sucked into the professorship, you know, that I have now. And now they're, you know, they're very proud that I'm a professor. I'm not sure what's how they feel about my being a poet. But so they, you know, they sort of didn't understand that kind of sideways entry into privilege, you know, right, through cultural. I mean, not that I understood it. I just loved poetry. But, you know, with the cynical eye of age, I see how that works.
Yeah, it is kind of like a mysterious path towards kind of, yeah, sort of a success. Let me ask you, you mentioned that you were the oldest. How many siblings do you have?
I have three younger siblings, and they're all still in the area.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's great. And was there any particular I was talking to Mary Ruffel about birth order. Was there any, last time I talked, did an interview with her, and was there any particular pressure or any direction that you were, I don't know, what was it like being the oldest?
Oh, it's terrible. The oldest it's great because you have a sense of your specialness.
Yeah.
And I see that replicated with my kids too. But, you know, my parents were very harsh on me. Like I said, they're immigrants. They're from Eastern Europe. Mm-hmm. They're very, they have no filters.
Right.
And so the pressure was on me to, you know, not only do well, but to be very good, to be obedient, to be very helpful. My siblings, you know, at least one or two of them have admitted that I was sort of a mother figure for a long time.
Oh, yeah.
When they were young. So, you know, you grow up too fast probably when you're the oldest.
Yeah. What is the age difference between yourself and your youngest sibling?
Oh, only 8 years.
Eight years.
My mom talked about.
Yeah, but that constitutes like the sibling mother dynamic for sure. And did you ever, you know, I always wonder, like, poets who come from kind of that non-literary maybe family, do you ever find it frustrating that, or are they ever kind of like barricaded from understanding the pleasures that you derive from poetry, that it's so foreign to them that they don't, you can't speak to them about it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. In fact, they haven't even acknowledged my new book. They just don't know how to acknowledge it.
Right. Yeah. Do you find that frustrating at all? That, or is that something that one comes to terms with in a way?
It's a minor, you know, wrinkle in life.
Yeah. You're not like, you didn't stop speaking to them because of that.
No.
Well,
as far as they're concerned, they just want me to be happy. Like, it doesn't matter what I really did. As long as I'm secure and I'm happy, they're happy.
Yeah, I totally get it. Let me ask you, when you finished up, I kind of purposely don't know a lot about your biography. I didn't want to know a lot because I wanted to ask genuine questions to you. After Brown, what was the time period between finishing the MFA and the publication of your first book? And what was that experience like, finally getting that first book published?
Well, I have to admit, it kind of fell into my lap. So I was, I was very lucky that way. I already had the book contract when I was at Brown.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the book came out very quickly, like a year maybe after less than a year after I graduated. And I was overseas. I was in Morocco at the time, so I kind of missed my own first book.
Oh, wow.
Because I wasn't there. I literally was in incommunicado in this crazy town in the mountains, in the Middle Atlas Mountains. So I didn't even really get to have I don't even think I had a book party or anything like
right.
that. It was, you know, and by the time I came back, it was old news.
No kidding. That is so funny. That is really strange, actually. It's like you missed the birth of your own child.
I was so excited. I was very happy, you know, to have the book. So excited and so excited when I got a starred review in Publishers Weekly. It was just so, everything was great. But, you know, I was living life. I was, you know, my husband dragged me to Morocco where he had a teaching job. And so I, you know, had always wanted to go to Morocco. And so, you know, there was no question that I would do that. And I had moved to New York. Then his job offer came less than a year like mm-hmm. 6 months after we moved to New York. So I basically left New York the same year I finally went to live there. And it was just a huge mess. Like, it's just, I can't even imagine it now. Although the risks you're willing to take in your 20s, you know. But so I was very busy at the time.
It does sound like you're very busy. Where did you meet your husband?
In college.
And, wow, so, and he got this gig in Morocco, and you were, was that just like a no-brainer for you, like, let's do this?
Yeah,
tell me about, because you're kind of notorious for, like, your traveling, and I'm wondering, like, so how long were you in Morocco?
I was there almost a year.
And then what'd you do after that year?
Went back to New York. At the time, I was in love with New York, and I wanted to be there. So, I don't know, Morocco, I remember what happened. My husband had gotten into Columbia Law School, and it was kind of a lark, because he already had a PhD in philosophy. That's what he was teaching in Morocco.
Oh, wow.
But the job market was so bad in philosophy that he decided to try law school.
Wow, that is really incredible.
Yeah, so he's been as busy as me.
And so you're in Morocco while he's teaching. Your first book comes out. You head back to New York, and he goes into Columbia's law school. And what are you up to at that moment?
I was working to support us, and yeah. I was working down on Wall Street as a technical writer.
Oh, wow.
Not exciting at all. I even had, like, I had people at parties just walk away from me when I said I was a technical writer, as opposed to being a poet, of course.
Oh, my God.
It was terrible. It was boring. It was just, you know, just a job to pay the rent.
Yeah. And then, a technical writer on Wall Street. Jeez. That was incredible. Where were you in your writing then? How was the formulation of your second book coming about?
It was hard. It was harder than the first book. It was being in New York had a very insular effect on me, probably. And I was, you know, reading a lot of New York school, which I always had, but then there I was right in New York, mm-hmm. reading New York school and going to readings at the St. Mark's Poetry Project. And so I feel like I was simply in a coterie there and trying to keep my head down and work. And it was very hard to do because New York does not lend itself to working. It lends itself to socializing. Or if your work involves socializing, that, you know, it marries the two things that suck up all your time. But poetry is so solitary. You really need more downtime. You need more time to brood and to process, and New York doesn't give that.
Yeah, that is so true. And so when did you end up, did you end up traveling back to the Mediterranean, like, long after your time in New York? What, did your husband finish up law school, and that was kind of a narrative marker to, like, did a new chapter start then?
The narrative marker for having kids. And so we ended up moving to Croton on Hudson, which is a train ride from Manhattan. Oh. And I was at home with two little kids while he went to work, and that's when I started really doing good work and writing essays and reviews and feeling like I was getting closer to my goal, my true poetry.
Yeah, that's interesting because, like, the stereotype kind of is, like, when the kids come along, like, the poet or the writer's production tanks, but yours seems to have to kind of increase, like, it's stabilized in a way for you to, like, kind of dig in. Is that right?
Yeah, that's absolutely right.
That's really interesting because now that I'm getting a timeline together, you kind of, like, were highly productive in the last, like, 7 to 10 years, really.
Right. I had prepared myself. I mean, I'd done a lot of work to prepare myself, but that was, you know, it was really just a preparation for, you know, after after having lived, you know, having lived a life. And I found New York extremely sterile in terms of living life.
Oh, wow, that is brilliant. And what brought you guys over to the Mediterranean?
Well, to be frank, the global financial meltdown. My husband lost his job, and he decided to go back into academia, this time teaching law. And he was able to get a job really quickly after losing his law firm job in Beirut, at the American University of Beirut.
Wow.
So that's what he did. He's still there, actually.
Oh, no kidding. That's amazing. And when that decision was made, so you're like kind of transplanting the whole family, and it also sounded like you kind of got into a nice kind of creative space and routine. Was it really like disruptive to move, or do you do this sort of like seamlessly? You're not necessarily a creature of habit.
It was the most difficult decision I'd ever made.
Okay.
And everything was very, very scary and in upheaval until we got there. And then it was like a dream. It was amazing.
Yeah, go ahead.
You know, it was, it's not a stable place. It's not a place where ordinarily you'd want to bring your two young children.
Right.
It's a very hard place to have children. But as a sort of renewal, it did the trick. And, you know, you're surrounded by so much history and so much culture, and it's mind-blowing. It's just so different from the U.S., and people are different people. There's a greater love of life. There's nightlife. There's dancing. There's music. There's passion. I mean, it's just a completely different mindset.
I know. I'm so fascinated by that. It seems like, I don't know, if like we're all uptight and embarrassed in America or something, but just kind of like the general, you know, the vibrancy that comes with leisure. I think here leisure is seen, is associated with laziness or somehow, like, where leisure is really often a vibrant celebration of your own humanity that other cultures seem completely to understand. When
it's
you
not
got
just leisure, it's sociality, you know, like,
yeah.
people spend time with people,
yeah,
doing fun things.
Darn it, they value doing fun things with other people better than us. That's so funny. How did your it's another stereotype is like, oh, uprooting kids is dramatic for the child, but children are so resilient. I guess it just depends on the disposition of the children. Did they, how'd they handle the move?
Well, my older child could handle anything. He's just great. And he was in first grade at the American school there.
Mm-hmm.
He had a great year, and he had friends, and he had a freedom that he doesn't have in the U.S., even
yeah.
if he lived in a suburb. I mean, he had freedom to roam as a six-year-old in a way we don't hear. But my three-year-old did have a hard time.
Yeah.
He was just acquiring language, and then we came to this place where there were three languages spoken the time. Sometimes, you know, three languages all at once. And so it did have an impact on him. And it was crazy because we lived on the sixth floor, I think, of an apartment building that was like all plate glass. So we had these beautiful views of, we had the Med, we had downtown Beirut, and we had the campus. And now I have this three-year-old who will charge through glass, you know, and right off the balcony. I don't keep an eye on him. So it's a bit crazy. We're always worried about him.
That is crazy. It must have been so strange just to sit back too and just see your children in such a foreign place. You're like, oh my gosh, like I'm operating a family life here. It must have been so weird. And it must have been odd to kind of, did you have the sense of coming full circle to your, to kind of the undergraduate years of studying the classics where you're like, oh my gosh, I'm like, it's coming back around.
Oh, absolutely. There's right on campus, there's a museum, an archaeological museum, and there were, you know, just there's all kinds of writing. I mean, writing originated in Phoenicia.
Right.
And so it was very exciting to look at these. They have a sarcophagus, which is the very first or the oldest inscription that they have in the Phoenician alphabet. And, and Phoenician alphabet became the Greek alphabet and hence our alphabet. So that was really going back to the origins of writing. And just, that was mind blowing.
Yeah, I love when, and typically I would think of like kind of natural landscapes doing this, but even kind of that kind of human history, I love it when things like that just kind of put you in your place. It reminds me of just like landscape paintings in early America with like the figure was always situated like real tiny among like canyons and trees. And in a way, it reminds me that you must have felt in a way like kind of this deep reverence for being physically where you were at, reconnecting with what you studied. And I wanted to ask you, with this book and the way you draw on that kind of classical history, it seems like some poets are drawn to more kind of the religious history, Christianity, Islam, or what have you. But you kind of went further back, and I know you have that your poems are very much sensitive to the passage of time and what it means for all of us. When did you get drawn, like as an undergraduate, to kind of going all the way back like that, as opposed to maybe certain more contemporary, like kind of religious history influencing your work, or are they both kind of interplaying with one another?
Well, I had the great good fortune of being raised Catholic, which means that I was already aware from a very early age of our narrative myths and stories and had an education in this other dimension, not only the spiritual dimension, but just the dimension of the past and, possibly the future, One of the first theological thoughts for me, one of the first existential thoughts I ever had was thanks to a Catholic catechism which stipulated that God had no beginning and no end. And I realized I could imagine no end better than I could imagine no beginning.
Wow.
And I was about 7. so it was always that. And so I always feel like it's sad when poets haven't grown up with that sense that, sometimes I think the whole problem with contemporary poetry is that there's just people are being raised without any religious cultural background.
I know, I always just find that amazing too, that there's such a knee-jerk reaction to throw religion under the bus, but, it's not all about, kind of propositions and whether they're true or not, that there's like a deep cultural like history treasure trove there, and that theology in many ways is trying to tackle some of the same issues as philosophy and everything else, but that you're right, that you're instantly kind of, and you said like when you're 7, there is something about being a child being introduced to those ideas that is so kind of freaky, that you get a sense of the bigness and the weirdness of your life. I always remember like laying in bed sometimes and thinking like as a child and just being weirded out at the idea that I could not exist or something. Weird. And in adulthood, I have a harder time kind of recreating that mesmerizing feeling, because as a child, there was some like physicality to it. It was weird. I want to kind of start moving into Marvelous Things Overheard. I want to ask you, though, I think in many ways, I think you might have said or written this elsewhere. And I do want to ask you, I have to remind myself about your experience writing prose. But with this book that I might have seen you argue that in many ways, in your own mind, it's more accessible in many ways than your previous work. Can you speak to this idea of accessibility in this book?
It's hard to see what other people see in your own work, but for me, it felt like I was embracing more of the prose of prose verses in these poems. At the same time that I was actually, you know, being very composed and working with the verse line, in some cases with verse here. But I think that for too long I was, you know, more confident of what the fragments could accomplish. And I'm less confident now about what the fragment can accomplish, at least for my purposes.
Hmm. And the prose kind of line, you know, those kind of more sprawling lines, I mean, that, it seems to simultaneously take a lot of courage to do that, because for me anyway, the longer the line, it just seems the more exposed and vulnerable you become. Did you have a sense of that at all?
Bliss Street? Do you mean in something like Bliss Street?
Yeah, exactly. Just kind of like this, not chattiness, but just just kind of a sprawling of language. Because I've read other poems by you that are kind of just like physically generous on the page, you know, mm-hmm. as opposed to something more stanzic. I don't know, but you did say you kind of embrace more of a prose sense. I guess I'm asking, like, what do you mean by that?
I think that, you know, I did feel very nervous about some of the more sprawling poems.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like, at the same time, I felt that there was a difference in reading the poems out loud to audiences that were more pronounced in favor of poems that sprawled out like that. It was really strange. Like,
oh, wow,
you know,
yeah.
I mean, I'm a person who believes in poetry on the page. I think the poem on the page is the radical thing.
Right.
But I think that when, you know, because so much of our job these days is reading out loud, reading to people, reaching people that way, I felt like I needed to be able to do both things. I needed to be able to write, you know, lapidary poetry, and I needed to be able to write poetry that that really communicated with people from the reading in the room.
Right.
And you know, I don't know if the twain shall meet. I really don't.
Definitely. Let me back up for a second and ask you about your experience writing as prose. Do you find that you'll have moments of getting more infuriated at your prose while you're writing it than your own poetry? Or I was talking to other people about this, and that they're much more compelled to walk away frustrated during the writing of prose than their poetry. What's been your experience?
No, I love writing prose. I love it. I mean, I don't do it unless I'm forced to, actually.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I only respond to assignments. I never, like, pitch assignments or write something and then try to sell. Almost never. I mean, maybe once or twice. But I'm very interested in the poem, in the particular problems of the poem, and increasingly the problems of verse.
Right.
And stanzas. But so, you know, it doesn't really, it's not a source of frustration. Writing is not a source of frustration. It's the best. It's, you know, it's where I feel my best. It's when my mind is the most fully engaged. It's when I feel I've done something worth doing in the world.
Right.
So I don't really feel frustration.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. Why don't we go ahead and open up the book and start taking a look at some of these poems and have you read a few. I was wondering if we could start out with the very first poem, The Grind. And let me just ask you before you read that. Some poets are very conscious of the ordering of their poems in the book, where the book is like mm-hmm. concept or object, or other poets I've talked to are like, I write my poems out without really the idea of a book, and then I basically just put them all together and make a book, and they're not really too, you know, or the editor will just kind of like, yeah, this one should go first. Okay. What's behind putting this poem as just kind of like the first kind of introduction to the reader? Is there anything behind it?
I just loved this poem. I was just so happy to have written this, this very, you know, it's very rhymey. It's very song-like. I usually try, I think, to put something very song-like right at the beginning of my books.
Oh, that's really interesting. And, well, let's go ahead and hear it.
Okay, well, you realize you set me up with that pay into my reading voice, and I'm terribly self-conscious.
Oh, my gosh, I didn't even think about that. Well,
then I have to replicate these perfect audios.
Well,
you know.
I will say this. You are on a cell phone, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I will just let everyone know right now that that is already going to compromise, you know, your voice in some way. So don't feel any pressure at all. I should have told you that at the end. I'm sorry.
All right. I'll give it my best shot. Here's the grind.
All right. Thanks.
The grind. Three cebettini for breakfast, where demand for persnickety bread is small, hence its expense, hence my steadfast recalculation of my overhead, which soars, and as you might expect, the cebettini stand in for my fantasy of myself in a sea-limbed prospect on a terrace with a lemon tree, not assessed a fee for rent sent a day late, not fines accrued for a lost library book, better never lose track of the date, oversleep and you're on the hook. It's the margin for error shrinking. It's life ground down to recurrence. It's fewer books read for the thinking. The hospital didn't rebill the insurance. The school misplaced the kids' paperwork. Here's our sweet pup, a rescue, which we nonetheless paid for. And look, he gets more grooming than I do. When I turn my handmill, I think of the dowager who ground gems on ham for her guests. The queen who ground out 2 cups of flour on the pregnant abdomen of her husband's mistress. I think of a great rock-eating bird grinding out a sandy beach, the foam said to be particulate matter of minute crustaceans, each brilliantly spooning up Aphrodite to Greek porticos and our potatoes and plain living, which might be shaken by infinitesimal tattoos.
That was beautiful. Thank you so much. And your voice sounded amazing. This poem is just so incredible to me. And the idea of the grind is like an origami that keeps on unfolding in many ways. You know, if the grind, I was kind of taken with the title and thinking about it, that grinding like will atomize things or grind things down to either like kind of a more agreeable consumption or later revised into some like greater totality. And then there's just kind of the grind of labor and all these kind of iterations of grind. And then the poem seems to take a rather dark turn as you yourself turn the handmill, which, and then, I mean, that is just a gorgeous stanza. You know, the queen who ground out 2 cups of flour on the pregnant abdomen of her husband's mistress. I was just like, oh my God, this is killing me. What do you want to say about this poem?
Well, those anecdotes can be found in Colin Zubron's book, Travels to Cyprus, or Journey to Cyprus, is it? It's in my acknowledgments. It's in there somewhere.
It's really just sinister, but also speaks to magic almost.
Well, it's Journey into Cyprus, and in this book, and in all of the books really that I was reading about the Mediterranean at the time, there's much discussion about the geology of the Mediterranean, and it's a rocky place, it's a stony place, and of course all the ruins that are excavated are, you know, writing on tablets, writing on stone sarcophagi, you know, graven images, so you know, mosaics, so everything, there's so much about stone.
Right.
And you know, the salt of the Mediterranean, Aphrodite coming from the sea, foam.
Mm-hmm.
The foam is actually, I had read, composed of these tiny little crustaceans. So the idea, I mean, the whole region is, you know, you just think of time grinding things down. So.
Right. And
really.
Oh, I was just going to say that the act of grinding is such a distinct process as well, and that, and what's indicative of process is design of some sort, and that the poem is in these kind of like nice rhymes, speaks to that design, and that ultimately design is kind of an act of seeking, and that's what I always get a sense from your poems, that they're seeking. And this poem, The Grinding, seems like a, in a echo of seeking in a way. It's really beautiful.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I also should say, in retrospect, I thought it must have also come out of the first poem in Anne Wintris's book called The Mill Race. It's in her book, what is that called? Capital, something with capital in it. Don't you know this book?
I don't.
Anne Wintris. God, why is my... I cannot remember anything. Her last book, it was 2005, 2006, and her poem, The Mill Race, ends with all these workers in Manhattan as, you know, Manhattan as a kind of mill grinding people down. So I think there must have been something at that in my mind when I was thinking about grinding, the grind.
Yeah, it's really fascinating.
Displaced of capital, that's what it is, the displaced of capital.
Yeah, I mean, the grind is like a form of kind of gruesome labor almost. The next poem I wanted you to read was Alexander's Naming of the Wind, and ironically, I was so bummed in a way because, not by the poem, but my choice of it in a way, because I just listened to the interview on KCRW, and I couldn't believe he had like picked that poem. I was like,
I know, it's so hard.
I was like, what do you do? And then I was like, well, I thought, well, maybe there's something to that the poem, you know, displays your sonic landscape so amazingly. Despite probably
some... You don't have to read it.
No, actually, I've been dying to hear you read it, so I'm going to ask you to. And I want to discuss it as well, so if you have anything to say about it before you read it, that's fine, or you can just start reading it.
Well, there's a lot going on in it, and I think I missed saying in the interview, in the other interview, that that Ezra Pound's cantos came into this too. The line, and I should have put this in my acknowledgments, and I simply forgot, but the thing about the king, no wind is the king, that's out of the cantos.
Oh, wow.
No wind is the king, so that's Ezra Pound. I don't know if it's translations, but
it's interesting how these things just shuttle in and out of one's poems, you know, that the... Oh, go ahead.
The cantos are, you know, they just sort of embed themselves in you. If you're not careful, you'll end up quoting them.
Seriously.
But yeah, so it's the cantos, and there was Aristotle. Aristotle was, of course, Alexander's teacher. So Aristotle has this possibly apocryphal treatise, the naming situation and naming of the winds and the names, and just the idea of naming winds, of course, is an exciting one. And
right.
You know, the Mediterranean has named winds still, Sirocco, the Mistral.
I know, it's so incredible because we only know the wind. It's interesting because the act of naming something, right, is to kind of, you know, and just kind of like hold it still with language and then go from there, and that the only evidence of wind is either feeling it or seeing it move something else. So the idea of naming it seems not dubious, but interesting. Yeah.
Well, at the same time, different people have had different names for the same thing. So, you know, Aristotle saying, well, here they call it the Taurus, but there they call it the something else.
Right.
So you're always kind of like looking for equivalencies, or, you know, not really sure where you are because you're not sure if that's the very same place, but we think it's the same place. And so it lends itself to a lot of, guessing and more of equivocation.
Exactly. All right. Whenever you're ready.
Okay. Alexander's Naming of the Winds. And I do want to add that while I have looked up pronunciations of these things, I quickly forget them. So if I mispronounce these ancient words, I have to go with it.
I am totally sympathetic to that.
If you'd seen lightning nets in clear water, midnight blue beyond the reefs, the pattern intact on nippled juglets, if you'd seen feral cats dozing on jagged steelies when the noon sun drugged us, you'd say, too, can't I have it? Or if I could describe it, I could have it, like an ancient contest. They say Apuleiotes is called Potamius here in Phoenicia. Between the mountains of Libanus and Epirus, it blows from a plain like a vast threshing floor. It might also be called Syriandus in the Gulf of Isis, which blows from the Syrian gates between the Rosian Mountains and the Taurus. In Tripoli, they call it Marcius. On the border of Syria, the southeast wind, the Eurus, is called Scopelius. But in Cyrene, it is known as Phoenicia. I can't have this. But they say these Phoenicians who sailed the Pillars of Hercules with oil to trade came back with more silver than they could carry and were forced to refit their ship's wheel, keel, and anchors with silver, not to mention their tableware, cookware, and fixtures. And though they say the Phoenicians received their name from the Greek phoenix eye to stain with blood because they slew and murdered as they streamed over the sea, if you'd seen the murex pits, the very waves dispurpling the shore with the dye of the snail, you'd know what those kingdoms were stained with. I can have it, describe it thus, and though no one can claim that this wind is the wind of the palace, we must hope for the Lucanotus, the white wind, to arrive from the south if the Potamius or Syriandus or Marcius or Phoenicius won't come to our aid. No wind is the king's. But if you'd seen, as I saw, at the fundus of the world, snakes desquamate their own simulacra, eggs shiver at a tamarine, a Eurydice essay toward the nest, for good measure, not to lose the contest, you would pray for a wind to come, the rough marine roof kicked up by the hoof of notice if necessary, its bad air notwithstanding, to bear you back to where the language boards auger into ears of matching description, though it cause great storms in the harbor at Posidonium.
Oh, that was so good. You totally killed that. That was great.
Thank you.
It's amazing the sound, just the prominence of the S sound throughout the poem. Until near the end, it seems like the R sound starts to kind of encroach in on the wind to either, I don't know, to almost like a foreshadowing the conclusion of the poem and the wind in many ways. It's funny that you said, it reminded me when you said that in many ways we're just like guessing the names of these winds. It reminded me of something that Thomas Hobbes said, that the best prophets are the best guessers. I don't know. It's just a really, really incredible thing. And it really kind of just opens up a quick conversation we can have about sound in your poetry. And, you know, kind of like, you must be in a way tired of hearing like you associated with all these amazing word choices and geez, you know, you're going to alienate some readers. And despite the fact that Google is so prominent in our life, but what I wanted to kind of, which is just a whole, yeah, I mean, that's just kind of fun in itself. But I do want to, and it's not that your poetry is so ornately, you know, kind of the words are so ornate that it's just a kind of a diamond wall that you can't penetrate. But because some kind of a common vernacular kind of like crops up in your poetry a lot. But this idea that, this idea of the plain spoken, though, you know, just kind of like no interest in kind of forgotten words that still just exist and are there for the taking. This idea of the plain spoken, and I always wrestle with that because I feel like we plain speak every day. Shouldn't poetry sort of offer us a new engagement with language, and that somehow the ethic of the plain spoken is some kind of leftover relic of kind of Romanticism's insistence on authenticity.
The vernacular, yeah.
Yeah, you know, and I just feel like I kind of gravitate to kind of the poetry that you write because it rattles me into a new engagement with language. Can you speak to that at all?
Well, there's so much to say about that, really. And sure, I am kind of annoyed at the resistance to it because there isn't the same resistance to it in the work of, say, David Foster Wallace or any number of prose writers. And people sensibly read those writers, that they have big audiences. So what is it about the use of a wide vocabulary in poetry that irks people where it doesn't irk people in the fiction world? So that's one question I have. The question of the plain style, you know, there's two ways to think about it. One is that it's traditionally, you know, in many poetry cultures, non-Anglophile poetry cultures, it's the norm for poetry to be elevated language.
Right.
If you talk to, people versed in Arabic poetry, and I love pre-Islamic Arabic poetry, you know, they will talk about the heightening of the language, the sense that you the sense that this is special language and it's rhyming and it's Baroque is essential to it being poetry.
Right.
And these were boasting contests. Those beautiful casitas, they were composed and sung in order to beat out the competition, you know. So the idea that you go over the top or that you're virtuosic or masterful is built into the expectation for poetry. Now you get to English poetry and you have this sort of, I don't even think it's a very interesting divide between the plain spoken and the Baroque or the metaphysical. Mm-hmm. And so people, sort of posit Ben Jonson as a model over John Donne, you know, or Shakespeare, or Milton over Shakespeare, and it's really silly. I don't know what to say about it other than it's a long-running argument. There's no conclusive evidence that, you know, the plain style is superior.
That's true. That would be, that would just be an impossible argument in my mind. But I'm just kidding. But I think it's a disposition of the poet as well. It's just maybe perhaps it has nothing to do with some sort of like kind of ethical decision about the work and that certain poets just have a disposition towards it. But then, like you say, in pre-Islamic Arabic poetry, it's more of like kind of a cultural like norm that this is part of the job of the poet to, that's why it's poetry and not something else. So,
exactly.
But I'm sure
it's
the argument. Oh, go ahead. What?
It's it's ceremonial language in most cases. Poetry,
yeah, precisely.
It's a religious or ceremonial, institution like Pindar. Pindar is another person who is considered, too ornate, too Baroque to even translate for a long time.
Right. And it's funny because a lot of, I don't know a lot, but some contemporary poets I read seem the voices or the language seems deliberately sapped of tone or any sort of, like you said, Baroque or kind of like interesting word choice. I don't know. It is kind of like.
Mm-hmm. I worry about it. I do worry that I think that, expectations have been lowered for poetry over the last 30 years, 30, 40 years.
Really. Yeah, and I saw that. I read in an interview, and I actually was able to, speaking about technology on Twitter, I just kind of threw it out there, but you used this term that you read in the Chicago Review as certain poets being aggressively minor, and I had never heard that phrase before, and I was just so taken with it, and actually the editor somehow tracked it down and got it and took a picture of it, and it was from like the 45th issue or something, I don't know. But this idea of aggressively minor that somehow, like, I don't know. I feel like I'm belaboring this too much. Let's move on. Let's take a look at Angie. Are you still there?
Yeah.
Okay, I just want to make sure.
No, I'm fine.
Okay, cool. Let's take a look at Bliss Street.
Okay.
And what a remarkable poem. Do you want to say anything about it before you read it?
It's very self-explanatory.
Yeah.
I'll go right ahead. It's called Bliss Street. And this is an actual street running by the American University of Beirut.
Okay.
From this balcony, the sight lines are clear to the rooftop volleyball court of my son's elementary school. From its mesh cage, the kids at PE class raise a right ruckus. I look over. Is he up there now? No, his is a different period. I'm squeezing some orange halves on a cheap plastic boat with a dome like a parliament and teeth at the spout to catch seeds and pulp, dragging a haul of juicing oranges all the way down campus in my bag stitched with the word Cyprus. I recall the oranges were mostly on the trees in Cyprus. It was the potato we were about then, the famous Cypriot, grown in red dirt and baked in its jacket, fluffy as a buttered cloud. We would pass the fields of red dirt and then a schoolyard and wonder what it would be like to be a child raised on an island like this, squat between sun and sea, never an ice age, abounding with indigenous flowers evolving freely without extinction, but, oh yeah, massacres, barbed wire slicing the casilla in a crescent ghetto. My grandmother picked potatoes on a collective farm at the age of 9 after her father died, but the funny story she told was of having shut herself inadvertently in the potato cellar while her mother was ill with pneumonia. The eldest child, she knew that if her mother died as well, it would be all on her shoulders, the infant, the other children. And already terrified to begin with, she began bawling. But, you know, someone let her out after a few hours. Her mother survived the pneumonia. She survived the potato farm. Then when she was 18 and working in a hospital kitchen, her supervisor opened the pantry and gestured toward the potatoes, pocketing some in her overcoat. She was terrified all over again. If she did help herself, their boss, a kind man, would find out. If she didn't help herself, her supervisor would know she knew. She didn't take the potatoes, and she didn't get fired. And decades later, she would return to the scene of demoralization, her version of the Stalin years. The volleyball court has gone silent. The PE teacher, whose name I don't remember, rests his arms against the ledge and overlooks the street, the campus, my building, in which I sit, stuck in a thought about potatoes. She stands there a minute or two in repose, then turns and walks away, leaving the scene unpopulated, as in some sketch or exercise by a painter removed from the north to a Mediterranean Arcadia full of ruins and cypresses. Oh, it would be an exaggeration to say it's full of ruins here. More like one of those mythological scenes with youths and gods in a crowded sky, Bliss Street overflowing with students, slowing traffic as they drift across the road, scooters clustered outside the gate inscribed with the motto, that life may be lived more abundantly. Perfect motto for a university. Perfect, as the fig trees were perfect that grew all into one boxy wreath round the dry fountains the kids on rented bicycles circled madly, that survived the Civil War by the looks of their thick trunks, ringed by apartment blocks and antenna raised into a looming cloud the color of putty. Putty, not putty.
That was beautiful. Thank you so much for reading that. It's really just an incredible poem because you take us in so many different places. And it seems, I mean, if I just kind of look through this poem so many times, but on the fourth line that, no, his, you know, speaking about your son, no, his is a different period. It just evoked that, the sense of history that you are so sensitive to. And then to go from there to, I'm squeezing some orange halves on a cheap plastic boat with a dome like a parliament and teeth at the spout to catch the seeds and pulp. Just, you know, using imagery and the image to indicate to the reader transformation that the orange, in somewhat of a violent way, is being transformed. And it reminds me of the grinding in the first poem that it takes us to dragging a haul of juicing oranges all the way down campus in my bag, stitched with the word cyber. The way, I think in so many of your poems, you brilliantly, like a mouse cursor on a computer, you guide the reader's eye where it needs to go. And that telescopes in and out usually of kind of scale. And then that scale of imagery is usually communicating something tremendous to the reader. And that it really, and it's such like kind of an old idea, the idea of imagery. And I know there's always conversation between imagery, maybe not verses, but imagery and physical imagery and the abstract, that the scaffolding of imagery in here is just so remarkable, and that imagery kind of recovers memory from kind of the decaying force of time and distance, and that you're kind of like, this is kind of like bringing back this internalized motion.
That's really the hope.
And then the red dirt, and then that, and really these, you turn your voice on a dime when you're like, but oh yeah, you know, I didn't even know how you were going to read that. You know, I would read it to, but oh yeah, the massacres. It was so like perfect. And yeah, and what about those massacres? Because the poem, and then it goes into this converse, you know, the story about your grandmother, and to end dramatically on her version of the Stalin years is just heartbreaking. It was just heartbreaking. And then to take us back to that rooftop of the volleyball court, it's just a brilliant ability to guide the reader and to really like tell the reader, like, you're in good hands here. I'm taking care of this. And then the PE teachers, whose name I don't remember, you know, really kind of echoed the poem about the wind for me and the incessant like instinct to name. And here the name, it totally escapes you. And what does that mean? Except somehow denuding that figure of some sort of importance. And yet he stands there a minute or two in repose. And I can only guess what, as he's gazing out, what is going on there. But then you bring up, it almost becomes these kind of pastoral gestures, you know. And it's weird to have pastoral gestures, which the bedrock of is kind of, you know, the idealization of something. And yet we have the Stalin years and massacres happening in the same poem. It's just a really accomplished poem, and I'm so glad I got to hear you read it. What was the composition of that poem like for you? Did it come quickly? What was that like?
My poems usually come quickly, at least the decent ones do. It's a good sign if it's not coming quickly that I should just, you know, stop. You know, there was so much going on in my life. It's the question is, where do you stop? You know, I could have probably gone on forever.
Exactly.
In a way,
yeah.
You know, with that song. And so it's a good thing that, you know, I just have my own ADHD. I just can't go on and on. but I did find out after I wrote that poem, I read Mahmoud Darwish's Memory for Forgetfulness. And I found out that park that I'm talking about, where the kids are riding their bicycles, that was the scene of a huge building collapse. A bomb, what they called a vacuum bomb, that was exploded by Israelis there in 1982, and it's flattened. You know, it's a very terrible scene in Darwish's book. And
right.
And then, you know, that didn't get into the poem, but it's inevitably going to always be connected there with that now that I know that. So there's always contingencies with poems that you're not in charge of. You can only just sort of, you know, maybe there is something to that, to prophecy or to guess it, educated guessing that goes on with poets as they get good at their craft.
Yeah,
I think
that's really amazing that you say that. And to have those children, such a key word choice, to have them madly, or, you know, just the sense that circular motion, you know, and how rich that is metaphorically to think about our lives or time or history. but the fact that they're children. And now, in light of the detail of that specific place you just told me, it just deepens or enlarges the power of that image. It's really incredible.
I mean, life is incredible.
I know. And that, you know, that's what I get exactly from your poetry is that if, you know, if the puzzlement of our existence isn't enough to freak you out in a wonderful, terrifying way, and then to move you to want to articulate that bewilderment, I don't know what's going on, you know?
Like, yeah, I know.
I just really, I don't know where, how one can't be constantly beside themselves. I'm going to have the last poem you read, which is Reason, Love, Control.
Okay. This also speaks for itself, I think. Reason, Love, Control. An onerogenic agent, the silene, will give you vivid dreams, or so a butterfly larva, like the gray kai, which feeds on it, could tell you. I am a scientist with an eldritch proboscis scouring the Siberian permafrost for one lupine or campion germ in a squirrel's Pleistocene stash. A sea Adam, a sea Eve, cast out some time ago, once looked at their hands and feet in astonishment. Now fish, now mammal, now both, thinks the breaching dolphin. And in that instant, death's opacity fills ampules of shrimp for our table. The here and now crowns shelves of rocks, tablets, bones, and papyrus stamped with a hermetic style. It would take a more original organ to decode. As to its low-slung Eden, our dolphin returns with a lunge. Against your mother's viscera, you felt the tide fall toward the foreshore. Your eyes you inherited from the stigma of a photosynthetic chloroplast. Your nose is but the pointed anterior end of the first flagellate presenting polarity. Your mouth the elaboration of the oral depression formed in response to the propulsion of the anterior flagellum. This inherited equipment suggests that nothing living, not even seaweed, deserves contempt, so long as the output makes good the wastage. Love sets its crampons in decaying somata as a fiddlehead stakes its sylvan citation on shot over land. We're sitting in my sister's house. We could go to the aquarium, she says. Medusozoan nerve nets. Pterophyllum altum, so laterally compressed that, like impending disaster, it disappears when regarded head-on. Right under my nose, my father diagnosed. And that smoothing out of every wrinkle in his brain, a transfer of fretwork to my face. So, say he is becoming more baby, as I become evidence of origami folded and refolded along a learning curve. Etiology speculative. Exposure to solvents, benzene, petroleum products, hypertension, loss of axons, cerebral infarction. I would have been kinder had I known the day he dismantled my car that widespread white matter, lesions, and hemorrhage were subtly but inexorably leading to impaired executive functions and processing speed. I remember that November day in Pennsylvania, mixing in every kind of sky and prying the leaves off one by one with as many pincer grips as a gale can chopstick. Coolly, the bodies of experts, the professional committees, hone their vocab to tweezers. And I love it, too. I love how it controls my breathing, subcortical, ischemic, for we life forms are evolving only toward more feeling.
Angie Malenko, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.